Good morning. We're ready to proceed with our briefing at this time. I'd like to introduce to you the gentleman who is the backup lunar module pilot for the Apollo 15 mission, scientist astronaut Jack Schmidt. Jack?
Thank you. I feel a little rested for a change, unlike the other morning, which I can't even remember when it was. Let me just say a few words about the lunar surface part of the mission. I'm not really up to date yet on the orbital science aspect of things. I hope to do that in the next couple days. But I don't think there's any question that we had a fantastic exploration mission on the surface of the moon at Hadley Base. The success of this exploration is not only due to the dedication and hard work of the crew, Dave Scott and Jim Irwin, but I'd like to try to mention a few of the other people who have been so deeply involved with training that crew, deeply involved with seeing that, to the best of their ability, the crew was able to accomplish the objectives of the mission, which have almost all been accomplished. Bill Finney and Gary Lofgren here at the Manned Spacecraft Center in the Science and Applications Directorate were deeply involved in this training, as were those individuals that made up the field geology team that operated with the Flight Control Division in the Mission Control Center, in particular Gordon Swan, Leon Silver, Tim Haight, Bob Sutton, and many other people, particularly associated with the U.S. Geological Survey. Members of the sample distribution team also participated with the flight control group in the Manned Spacecraft Center, although they hadn't been as closely involved with the crew training. Bob Pepin and Dale Jackson, who sort of filled a dual role of being an instructor, and particularly on the trip to Hawaii, and also working with the sample distribution team. I say all of this mainly to emphasize once again this group of scientists that have now become a major and integral part of the Apollo team, as we phrase it, and have dedicated a good part of their professional careers now and are continuing to dedicate those careers to the success of our lunar exploration program. Now, that program right now can look at Apollo 15 as its classic operation. We selected the Hadley Apennines area as a landing site for Apollo 15 because we felt we were going to be able to look at a broad spectrum of lunar history, particularly that history connected with the early formational days of the moon, and also giving us an opportunity to examine the solar history book, as I phrased it, the solar history book that's developed upon the surface of the various geologic units that have been formed at the Hadley Apennine site. The first two EVAs, particularly the second EVA, ensured that we would gather, or had gathered, the samples representative, I believe, of a large section of lunar history that was exposed in the front of the Apennines on the smaller mountain called Hadley Delta. All the observations of the crew about the nature of the terrain there, the way it contrasted with Amari, the nature of the slopes leading up to the sample area, the kind of soil, the very fine nature of the soil, the lack of large blocks, what they could see farther up the slope in terms of the nature of the craters, the apparent bright ejecta blankets around craters higher up on the slope. All of these are factors that indicate that the samples collected were from debris that had come largely off the front of the Apennines. Now, this Apennine front, because of the nature of its formation, that is, as an uplifted rim of the Imbrian Basin, at the instant of formation was a section, almost certainly a section of geologic units, relatively, in general, flatline geologic units, that represent, that could have had, and from what we know now, probably did have, a lower portion that was part of the original lunar crust, a next section that was the ejecta from the Serenitatis Basin, formed prior to the Imbrian Basin, and then on top of that, the ejecta from the Imbrian Basin. Now, there may be several other geologic events in that section. You can speculate on some of them, volcanic events that followed each of the major basin formations, things like that. It's not those are considerably more speculative, I think, than the three that I've named. Now, based on the observations of the crew, reported observations of the crew. Now, another major objective was an attempt to understand the origin of Hadley Rill. Now, this is not unrelated to the origin of Mare, since the rill and almost all the rills we're aware of are largely part of, or at least cut through, Mare units. Now, from the previous missions, we have a good understanding, I think, of the origin of the Mare. By the samples collected on previous missions and by the added to the interpretations of photography we've had for some years, it's pretty clear the Mare are composed of superimposed basaltic flows, somewhat different than the basalts we have on Earth, but somewhat similar in many respects. Now, I think that the observations, particularly on the third EVA, of the strong layered appearance of the walls of Hadley Rill are additional confirmation that, in fact, our first interpretations have been largely correct. But being able to see those features in the walls of Hadley Rill make it even more difficult to interpret the origin of the rill, because many of the origins of rills of that nature would have said you wouldn't see that kind of feature in the walls. The thing that I think impressed me, not only with the Apennine front but with the rill, was the long time that has passed since these features were formed on the moon. Something we had noticed in the map, pre-mission mapping for Apollo 12, that very large depressions that have slopes comparable to those in Hadley Rill or the Apennine Front commonly have large blocks exposed in the walls of these depressions. It appears that the rate at which very fine particles move down slope on the moon is greater than the rate at which blocks are eroded. So your older slopes and older depressions tend to have exposed blocks on them because the fine particles have moved down slope. And this is why earlier in this session I emphasized the very fine particle nature of what is the base of the Apennine front, as indicating material had moved down the slope of the Apennines. And at Hadley Rill, with the large number of exposed blocks in its walls, plus the fine particles that appear to be down in the bottom and the blocks down there, indicate the same process is going on in the walls of Hadley Rill. So there may have been considerable erosion taking place to eventually expose these layers in the walls of Hadley Rill. Nevertheless, the rill is not that degraded that we could have exposed eroded an extensive amount of the wall. So I suspect that the original wall of Hadley Rill had layers in it much like what was observed by the crew. So that's going to have to be factored into the thinking of the origin of rills. And I frankly, in my own mind, am not sure that until we see the samples that we're much closer right now to understanding the origin of the rill than we were when we started, except that there probably are some origins that can be eliminated now. Another factor in that origin is the description of the rocks made by the crew, that they were highly vesicular. That is, they had spherical or subspherical holes in them. And this was the same description of blocks that we feel were, and they felt were, blocks of the Mare some distance away from the rill. This also indicates that the Mare units are of the same kind and possibly continuous right up to the edge of the rill. Again, some origins that have been proposed for the rill would have implied that you'd get a change in the kind of rock as you approach the rill. There's no indication yet in the descriptions of the crew, anyway, that change does take place. So in summary, I don't think we really know the origin of Hadley Rill yet, but I think we can go back and look at all the theories and start eliminating some of them. And that's about the most you can often expect to do in geology. The North Complex, which was an area that we missed because of the shortened duration of the second EVA, the third EVA, was the last major objective that we had in terms of priority, and I believe we probably haven't missed that objective entirely, because we do have the photography that was of that North Complex that was taken not only from the limb during the stand-up EVA, but also from other points along the traverse as part of the panoramas that the crew takes as a normal course of their activities. So there's a lot we've learned to do in the past 10 years of lunar geology to interpret photographs, and I suspect that we're going to get a good feeling for what the actual origins of the North Complex are. The only unfortunate thing is now that we do not have a systematic sample of that complex. We very probably will find that we do have samples, because that's the nature of things on the moon. The cratering process tends to mix the surface of the moon, and in some of the secondary craters that were sampled by the crew, and in some of the rocks gathered in a statistical way by the use of the rake, these may well contain rocks that we can correlate back by a variety of indirect arguments to the North Complex. North Complex would have been an exciting place to go, but we never really expect to get everything done that we plan to try to do on these missions. We plan for a nominal mission, that everything's going to go well, and a few things start accumulating, and you lose time in fixing them, and you have to give up some of the objectives. I guess one of the things that there's been a lot of question about, I know everybody in the Mission Control Center, when it was actually happening, kept questioning themselves, are we doing the right thing? And that was the time spent in trying to recover that drill core. I think what everybody who was thinking about this at the time, from the scientific angle, everybody finally fell back on to justify it in their own minds and continued to encourage the crew to try to accomplish this task, this was our first really nearly complete record of the nature of the lunar regolith that we were going to have the opportunity to obtain. As I said, I think in our last briefing, it's in this regolith, this soil layer on the moon, that was where we expect to find the record of the sun's radiation and the sun's magnetism throughout many millions of years and possibly 1 or 2 billions of years. And that record is an exceedingly important part of our total lunar exploration program. Is without understanding that record, as I've said before, it's going to be very difficult for mankind to understand what's happening and what has happened to his terrestrial environment. And it's probably only on the moon. I can't think of any place else in the solar system that you have such an opportunity to really understand what the sun has done throughout geologic time. So I think in retrospect and also in, as we say, in real time, everybody intuitively felt that we needed to do everything possible to recover that core. And in fact, I think there's no question now that we have recovered it, and that provided NASA and the scientific community can finally decide on an organizational mechanism for analyzing these cores, which I'm sure they will, it's just a very difficult problem to tackle because it takes so many disciplines. Provided they can decide on an organization for this, I think that in the not too distant future we'll see a much greater understanding of the history of our sun than we have to date. Now, if there are any questions, I tried to cover some of them. I hope I did.
Please wait for the mic, if you would. Would you identify yourself, everybody, as you come up?
Arthur Hill, Houston Chronicle. There's a couple of things I'd like to get an explanation on. On the first EVA, I believe it was Scott made reference while digging a trench to a bet that he had with you of some nature. I'd like an explanation of that. And also, the sizes of the vesicles appears to be of some importance, and I wish you would sort that out for me.
Okay, that bet. I knew you people were going to think that was a bet that Dave and I had. It turns out that some months ago, in a discussion with Don Wilhelms of the U.S. Geological Survey, we were trying to decide whether there was what the chances were of seeing original lunar crustal material, which we all felt would be crystalline, that is, a rock composed largely, if not entirely, of crystals. What the chances were of finding that in this particular mission. And Robin Brett of the Manned Spacecraft Center at some subsequent time got involved in this little discussion, and so I have a small bet of a bottle of wine with each of these gentlemen that some 50% of the rocks collected at St. George Crater would be composed of crystals averaging 1 millimeter or greater in size. It's a simple bet. Unfortunately, it may be a little bit hard for us to resolve because, as usual, and that's what your hope is when you make bets of this kind, that you both end up buying a bottle of wine and drinking it. So that's the bet. It was not with Dave Scott, but it became a fairly popular item of discussion in any of the geological briefings that we had. We'll see. It's from the descriptions Dave made, and I think I stand a pretty good chance of winning, but I suspect it's going to be a very close race.
I think the second question was on the...
Second question, vesicles. This is one of the spectacular things that we've seen in the lunar rocks. We got our first hint of these very large vesicles in the Apollo 12 samples, and it sounds like that they are very abundant here in the upper part of the mare area at the Apollo 15 site. I suspect that in these large vesicles we're seeing the remnants of some fluid. In fact, I'm certain of that there some gas or fluid has separated from the original magma while it was molten, while it was still liquid. That's the original lava, while it was still liquid, and accumulated as a sphere of gas as this thing flowed out onto the surface. The big question is, for geologists anyway, I doubt if it's a very big question for you, is did these large accumulations of gas form while the magma was deep within the moon, or did they form while it was on the surface? Directly related to that question, well, if they formed while they're deep within the moon, that probably means that magma sat within the moon for some period of time while this thing happened, and then it was extruded. And that's an additional step in the process of forming magmas on the moon that has to be explained in understanding how these things form. The same goes for what you may have heard the term phenocrysts, that is, large crystals that form within the within magmas, and you see subsequently a lava will have be mostly fine crystals, but there'll be some great big olivines or great big plagioclase crystals in them. The bubbles are roughly the same kind of thing. In fact, it's exactly the same kind of thing. It's a separation of a phase from a liquid system. Now, what that's one of the interest in this. The other thing is that they may, these vesicles may well be indicative of the tops of flows, and so they were described in several different locations, including down as a crew walked down into the rill just a little bit. And so we may be, they may be a way of later correlating boulders photographed and rock sampled with the tops of lunar flows. So in a detailed way, that sounds like the vesicles are going to be a very important clue in our total understanding of the site.
I got a follow-up.
All right, go ahead, Art.
Well, can you then, when you get the samples back, tell whether the vesicles are a result of the original magma or are on the surface? Can you resolve it?
Well, I think with this collection of rocks, we can now start again a systematic analysis of the vesicles, of the materials that are on their walls, and of the rocks they're in. I should have said that probably the most significant thing about these is that they imply the existence of fluids at some time on the moon. But so far, in the look at the Apollo 12 rocks, we can't see any sign of those fluids other than the fact they left a sphere there. Normally on Earth, when you have fluids in rocks, they alter the rock. After they formed, as the rock cools, you get different kinds of minerals. One of the most common fluids in the basalts of the Earth is water. Water, in particular, forms vesicles in basalts on Earth very commonly. We see this. We can see it happen in Hawaii, for example. Physically see it happen. But so far on the moon, we haven't seen any sign of the material that originally was in those holes. And so that's an extremely exciting thing for everybody, is to, was there a primordial or original lunar atmosphere that, and at least during the time when these flows formed? What happened to the fluids that were in those holes? And nobody knows right now. There has to have been something, and we really don't know what happened to it. It may have reacted with a rock and it had been a different kind of fluid, composed of elements that would form the minerals that the rock now has, and we just can't, right now, have not been able to resolve which minerals those are. But it's a very interesting question for...
Go ahead, John. We'll get over to you, gentlemen. Just be patient. I don't want this young man running back and forth.
John Lennon, The Washington Star. How much real core did they retrieve? And I have a couple follows on that.
How much core? Well, in the drill core, because of the difficulty that the drill went down and the cohesive nature of the soil that was described in several different occasions, I suspect that that's almost a complete core. Let's see, those are six sections of about 16 inches apiece, so what is that, 96 inches, something like that? So core recovery is never 100%, although we may have gotten pretty close to it here. I suspect it's good. Now, we had also some of the drive tubes, and I've forgotten exactly how many of those we got, six or so, lose track. But they also provide the same kind of a record. And probably in the drive tubes, your actual layering is going to be better preserved, because there's a little less disruption of the ground as you drill a drive tube than when you have this percussive, rotary percussive action of the drill. But it ought to be good in either case.
And were there any multispectral photos taken on the surface, and if not, why not?
No, we don't have a multispectral camera. We do have a piece of equipment called a polarizing filter, that polarimetric filter that has been carried as a low priority experiment on several missions. 14 took a few of these, as I recall. And we were going to try to do that on the second third EVA, found that because of dust on the camera, the filter was not fitting very well, the first thing. And then later on, I think in the press of activities, because we ran behind on that drill, that this was not accomplished. I don't know for sure. The crew may have done it. I just don't remember any voice transmissions that indicate it had been done. What it tries to do is, by rotating a filter, just see, are the rocks, in fact, polarizing light that's falling on them?
You said, take one more and then we'll jump around.
And the final one, You said that the famous anorthosite fragment is going to throw out some theories. Can you tell us which ones are going to be thrown out?
Oh, I don't know that I said that. When I said some theories were going to be eliminated, it was reference to the rill, the layering seen in the rill. The fragment itself, I think, confirms the wisdom of the choice of the Hadley site as a landing site, because the prime objective was to go to the front and to try to sample original lunar crust, and I suspect we did that with that sample. There are probably others. I think people, both geologists and the layman, maybe think that finding anorthosite is the save-all of lunar science. I suspect the lunar crust is more complex than just anorthosite, although many papers have been written implying that anorthosite is what it's composed of. Anorthosite, by the way, for explanation, is a rock composed largely, if not entirely, of plagioclase. And we have seen chips of fragments in the other landing sites, particularly Apollo 11, that were anorthositic or were anorthosite. I suspect we're going to find that there, in those samples, there are other kinds of rocks that are associated with this anorthosite in the lunar crust. But it's a prime candidate. There's no question about that.
Bill. Bill Hines of the Chicago Sun-Times, what you did say, if my notes are correct, was that certain theories had been eliminated regarding the origin of Hadley Rill. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what theories were eliminated and what theories remain, and also whether any other theories about the moon have been either demolished or reinforced by this mission.
You guys ought to listen to geologists more often, because we almost never make a flat statement. See that? Almost never. Geologists traditionally have been bitten by making flat statements, that it's part of your normal education, is to have plenty of probabilities and almost and mays and things like that in whatever you say.
Very similar to public affairs.
It's going to be difficult, very difficult, to say anything's eliminated until we have a chance to look at the rocks and to analyze them chemically and pull together all the verbal information that the crew provided us with, just see the total picture. I think that with reference to the rill, that rill origins by methods of fluid flow and fluid erosion are slightly less likely now than they were before. What our experience is on Earth of processes like that, I think it's a little less likely that these origins are correct for the rill. I can't say they're eliminated, but I think that they're a little less likely. I think it's starting to look a little more likely that maybe some process by which the crust or the Mare surface was fractured in a sinuous way. For Hadley Rill now, there are rills and rills and rills, and Hadley Rill is all I'm talking about, that was fractured in a sinuous way is more likely. I would like to wait and see not only the rocks that were sampled from the rill itself, but the soils that were sampled along this, what the crew referred to as a levee on top. If there was fluid flow, then the presence of a levee is a very common feature for fluid flow operations. And if those samples on the levee, in quotes, or that ridge that ran parallel to the rill, are significantly different than the soil samples taken elsewhere, then again, I'd go right back on the other tack and say maybe the fluid deposition theory is a little better. So you see, I've sufficiently clouded the whole issue there that you don't know what I think.
Well, the other half of the question, just a sec, Bill.
The other half of the question was whether any other theories about the origin of the moon, exclusive of Hadley Rill, had been either demolished or reinforced by this mission.
I think that the net result of the mission was to indicate that our preliminary thinking about the moon, and particularly that thinking that led to the selection of this of a site, has been largely vindicated, that our total picture of the moon as it's developed particularly since we started sampling the moon, that total picture that's been growing there is still looks like it's a valid picture. It's a valid foundation on which to attempt to further select sites and to further approach the analysis of the rocks and soils that are brought back. Now, that picture is a complex one, but I think it's starting, and I gave part of it there when I gave you the idea of how the lunar crust may have formed with the early melting. Subsequent to that, we think that there was a period of cooling of the crust of the moon and then a gradual accumulation of radioactive heat that then at another time melted part of the moon. And at that point in time may be when the Mare formed. Now, there are many complexities all along that chain of lunar history. But I think that what we've seen so far, and I say we, I mean the team that includes the crew, what we've seen so far and what they've reported indicate that, yes, that still seems to be a valid approach to lunar science. You never really know, and we found so many surprises now in analyzing the rocks on the moon, that you never really know for sure that this is right, and you may sometime soon have to suddenly regroup and go back and find another way of explaining things. But as far as any major theories, from the point of view of the people I am directly associated with, and that is the field geologist and the geochemist who try to look at the moon in a general way, I think that none of our feelings have yet been demolished, if you will, by the results of Apollo 15. That's not to say that we haven't changed our mind in the course of lunar exploration. If you had me up here 6 or 7 years ago and asked me what I thought the origin of the moon was, it would have been an entirely different story. It's an accumulative thing. Every time we get a new fact, it works into this framework, and we gradually build this thing, that a very gross outline of which I've given you.
Are you at a follow-on, John? Then we'll come
over. I've got a follow-on that real answer for Bill. John Wilhelm, Time Magazine. Jack, why, if you do have a levee along the side of the rill, do you tend to eliminate the fluid erosion?
Well, there's one problem is that you don't see it on the other side. At least there's no evidence in the photography or the topographic analysis that we had prior to the mission that exists on the other side. Now, where we've seen fluid flow on terrestrially, you get a symmetrical levee distribution. That's a big question I have in my mind, is this lack of symmetry of that levee. I'll try to explain it a little bit. The Mare in this part of the moon is very thin, relative, say, to the middle of the Imbrium Basin or other places. It's coming up, it's lapping up, if you will, at the edge of the Apennine front, and relative to other parts of Mare, it's thin. It's probably, actually, it may well be no deeper than the depth of the rill itself, and it might even be shallower, and the rill may have penetrated materials underneath, too. And when you have a situation like this, where the Mare is thin, plus a basic fact that when basalts cool, they contract by, actually, if you just took a cup of basalt liquid here and cool it, it would contract by 10%, on the order of 10% of its original volume as a fluid. So by contracting and in cooling, you're going to get tremendous stresses developed within the basalt itself, and it's also going to tend to deflate. So any irregularities of the surface underneath the Mare, the original surface underneath the Mare, are going to influence what happens as that thing contracts. And normally, in terrestrial basalts, in unconfined areas, the contraction takes place on a small scale, and you get what we call columnar joints. Those of you who have seen Devil's Post Pile and the Columbia River basalt see these columns that develop, vertical columns. Well, that's a direct reflection of this contraction. On the moon, that almost certainly will take place also. But also in confined areas, you may tend to get pull-apart structures. You may see I think the crew referred to a water level, a high water mark on the sides of things where the, and then the rest of the basin is contracted enough so that that is exposed. The another possibility is that where you have, say, a ridge underneath your this pool of mare, that as the material contracts around that, you may get a crack, tensional crack, that parallels that ridge. And I'm giving you all of this complexity of information here to understand that you not only may have formed the rill by contraction, but you may have a reflection of that underlying ridge that makes it look like a levee. And just because the mare is bowed up there a little bit, and it's layers within the mare themselves are sloping, and the edge of that, where that layer comes to the surface, is going to look like a little ridge. I'm just giving you an alternative of how you may form what looks like a levee and it not be a levee at all.
Yeah, I understand.
It just it's going to take months, if not years, to pull together all this data, the chemical and the photographic and the descriptive data, in order to be able to say, yeah, that's probably a rill formed by water erosion or by lava erosion or something like this, or it's formed by contraction, a fracture due to contraction. I think that there are probably more important questions to treat with respect to the moon than the origin of rills, but we never know exactly what's an important question in any area of science until you understand it. And it may turn out that that's one of the more fundamental questions about the moon. We just don't know enough about it yet, and it's obviously a difficult one, or I wouldn't have spent so much time talking about it.
As you can see from your questions already, that there are not very simple or short answers. We'll do the best we can to get to as many of you as possible. I see a lot of eager hands. We'll do the best we can. Mrs. Sullivan will take you next.
I talk too much anyway, so I'll try to make them short.
That wasn't the reference.
I know you guys. You're always trying to turn
this
us off.
This is going to be a very long. This answer to this will be quite prolonged. How long did it take to get that core?
I didn't figure it up. I think the total man hours were probably close to two. I think you ought to, before you quote that, you ought to talk with, try to get a hold of Ray Zediker or some of his people, and because they keep close watch on this kind of thing, and they can probably give you an exact answer. See, there was some time spent on the first EVA near the end just to connect it with the making sure we could keep the drill so it would operate, and then the second EVA sometime spent in drilling it, and then the third EVA sometime spent in recovering it. I'm just not sure what the total would be, but it was probably on that order, man hours, 2 hours.
Bill?
Bill Rice, New York Daily News. Two questions, Jack. Number one, you've been talking about we each time you're mentioning the geology group and such. We had a group of scientists here during the EVAs, and they weren't quite so sure as to the formation of the moon and such. You seem to present one complete genesis of the moon as your working model, or did I get the wrong impression?
As I was talking, I was thinking that I might have left you with that impression. When I say we, I'm talking about a team of people that with some changes in personnel, but some continuity also, a team of people that has included the crews, but it also included a large number of active scientists who are working on an almost daily basis as part of NASA and as part of this country's Apollo program. They're the people that are most deeply concerned on a day-to-day basis with what sites are selected, what are we going to try to do on the missions in a detailed way. And these people have a sort of, and the ideas about the origin of the moon are sort of the ideas that guide our everyday thinking about what's important and what isn't important. That's not to say that other scientists who are on the periphery of this group who are extremely interested and extremely dedicated in their own way to what we're trying to do on the moon, and sometimes have ideas at variance with what we say, and there are those kind of ideas internally in this group also, but that they are not listened to. As a matter of fact, in the site selection meetings, these people are very, very prominently represented, and I think have influenced in many ways our selection of sites. Harold Urey in particular, for example, the idea of wanting to get a site at the edge of a major basin on the moon was something he fought for in a figurative sense for a long period of time. And Hadley, although there are many other reasons for selecting Hadley, that does in part reflect his influence. And there are many other examples, and I just picked Harold as one. I'd like to think that none of us who are active on a day-to-day basis in this lunar science program ignore the wishes and ideas of people on the outside. It's just that it's never possible in something as big as this program to completely satisfy everybody. And I think that we have done a pretty good job at satisfying most people. Maybe we go overboard in that respect because it means there's an awful lot. We try to do an awful lot on these missions, but there's no other choice, really.
But right over there. Keep the mic going. There we are.
Stu Auerbach, Washington Post. Jack, two questions somewhat connected. What do you think the odds are of you being the first PhD geologist to land on the moon? And secondly, connected with that, there has been some controversy over the misuse of scientists, astronauts, and not letting them do explorations. Do you feel that scientists like yourself and Joe Allen are fulfilling your full role as a scientist and working on the ground in these missions and providing a kind of needed interface between the flyers and the scientists?
Well, in terms of odds, you're going to have to talk to people a little higher up the management chain than I am. I really don't know what that is. You people have been around long enough to have watched the development of exploration, really an age of exploration, we commonly call it a program, in the last 10 years. When I was selected as a scientist astronaut, you couldn't convince me, or you couldn't convince, when I finally learned something about the business, and you couldn't convince George Lowe or anybody else that we were going to land on the moon the first time we tried it. Most of the vehicles we bought were as a hedge because we really weren't sure we were going to know how to do it by 1969. When you're trying to do something for the first time with complex engineering devices such as spacecraft, there's absolutely no question that you go to the people who are most qualified to operate and understand those machines. And in this respect, I think that I certainly would have done the same thing in terms of selecting test pilots to be the prime to be the crews that would fly these early missions. If I were planning a geological expedition into the western part of the United States, I would pick professional geologists to do that. It's the same thing. I would not select a test pilot to do a geological job, and I wouldn't select a geologist to do a test pilot's job. In anticipation, however, that there would be a time where the job of learning to fly the vehicles and learning the systems and learning just what we had as a transportation system, NASA, and particularly with the encouragement of the National Academy of Sciences, did select some scientist astronauts, and they've done this in two groups. I think that there's one other factor that you have to remember. In not knowing how long it would take us to be able to land on the moon, you selected a large number of people. And these people had a very as astronauts, and these people had a very special role to play within NASA, and I think they've played it extremely well, and I'm happy to have been part of that role. But in order to get the people you needed to have to fulfill this role and to be available for flight, they had to think and they had to know, really, that barring other unforeseen circumstances, such as flight cutbacks and program cutbacks as we've had, that they would have a chance to fly. And I certainly think that that's true, and so that the sequence of which crews are selected is something that reflects a sequence that has been put together in the past. It's purely a function of the kind of program that we thought we were going to have to be ready to fly. And had the cutbacks not occurred, I think that the chances of me flying to the moon would have been excellent. Right now, I don't know what they are. I think because of the loss of Apollo 18 and 19, I think the chances of any scientist astronaut going to the moon are probably fairly small. They were quite large, I think, prior to that time. The future assignments in Skylab, I think the chances of scientists flying are excellent. Everybody, I think, within NASA realizes that that is an important use of the near-Earth part of this frontier that I like to talk about, and that in order to use that fully, you're going to have the experience, the years of experience represented by scientists. And I think you can anticipate, I like to think you can anticipate that scientists will be part of those missions. What will happen with the lunar side of exploration, the real outposts of exploration, I don't know.
If I, we'll pick up this question in just a minute. I understand that the crew is now awake, and we are talking to them at this time. I would say that we'll be coming up in the hour in about 8 minutes, and that we'll wrap up at that time. I'll try to take as many questions in the meantime, and I'm going to take them from the hands that have been up the longest, as far as I can tell. This gentleman right here. You've had your hand up a long time.
I've got two questions, Jack. First one, a follow-up on Stu's and to your answer about Skylab. What's your comment on the fact that this is supposedly a Earth orbit scientific exploration, and you've only got three scientist astronauts in the running for the cruise? And the second question is, how as you as a geologist, how did the TV from the moon help you?
I don't know what the crew assignments for Skylab are. I don't think there may be somebody that knows. I know there's a group of people working on Skylab right now, just like in the past that we've had groups of astronauts working on various programs. I haven't been, of course, for the last year and a half, I haven't been very close to that program. But I know of no specific crew assignments yet in that field, and I'm not even, I don't think I'm convinced that the people working on it now are necessarily the total pool of people that from which the crews will be selected. I'd like to think that if it wouldn't be completely closed in case somebody decides I shouldn't go to the moon, I would like to have an opportunity to observe the Earth. And the television question, I and numerous other people have fought for many years to have argued in within the NASA to have a television system that would be mobile and of nearly continuous use for the ground to not only observe the nature of the lunar countryside, but to be better able to anticipate what questions a crew might have and what questions might be pertinent as a result of what the crew is doing. I think there were many examples in this mission where, because we were able to observe the operations of the crew and anticipate where they were going to be next and where they were going to go next and when they were going to be through with some task, that then the ground could suggest another task or a curtailment of tasks based on the total priorities. A crew, you just can't expect in the course of training to develop a complete perspective on all the objectives that we put on these missions. There are just too many of them. And particularly when you get in the heat of battle, that is the heat of actually performing a given task, you're just impossible to think so far ahead that you can say, okay, it's time to stop this, to start this. And that's what we expect the ground to do when we're flying. We expect the ground to watch over us in that respect and make sure that we are living up in general to the objectives of the mission. On the other side of that coin is the ground, as a result of the training on this mission, I think learned, and we expect them to learn, not to overreact. That is, not to try to direct the crew on a minute-by-minute basis. And I think that that has worked out very successfully on Apollo 15.
Okay, Mark?
Two. One is a follow-up to Stu's question. I, as long as you brought it up, I don't quite understand anymore why a scientist astronaut such as you would be so welcome on 18 and possibly not on 17. The old arguments don't seem to hold water anymore. And the other question is it struck me that despite the great advantages we have had in 15 over the previous missions in mobility and so forth, that man still is pretty inflexible on the moon in the Gene Shoemaker sense. And I wonder whether you think there's still any chance to increase his ability to work even more in the subsequent flights, last two flights.
Well, as far as the 18 versus 17 question, I think that's a question for NASA to answer themselves. NASA is committed to a, well, I can't answer it. I may have brought up the question. I can't answer it. NASA is committed to a sequence of space flights for which there have been crews training for some time. Just because a 15 was the mission up doesn't mean there aren't crews training for other missions. And it means a departure from an already established policy, in a way, informally established policy, to make changes in the way you select those crews. And it's not up to me to do that. I can't. I have no influence over that other than the extent of which I do my job. So I'm really, I can't give you an answer, Mark. I wish I could, because obviously I'm very anxious to fly to the moon. But I also think I understand all the pressures, other pressures that are on people within NASA, scientific and otherwise, the pressures that determine what crew actually flies. I think there has to be a decision before very long, but I really don't know what that decision will be. Your other question was flexibility. We, with a 15, I think just because we spent 15 months training for six people to be observational scientists, and in particular geologists, two looking from 60 nautical miles at the moon and four looking at the surface from close up, we spent such an extensive amount of time relative to other missions that flexibility was obviously increased by, pardon the expression, orders of magnitude. And I think Dave and Jim demonstrated that had been done. If anybody has any question about that, I'd like to have a chance to talk with them at a greater length informally. There's no question in my mind that we sent two very competent observational scientists to the moon. Their operations on EVA-2 and at the RIL on EVA-3 are a clear demonstration of that you had you had two thinking men at that up there. That kind of flexibility, I think, is indisputable now. The flexibility as a result of hardware or of numbers of EVAs and things like this it's related to many different things. I think the number of EVAs is probably about right. There, I think, can be debated the value of the SIVA exercise versus the stand-up EVA versus preserving, say, a full three EVAs or possibly in a nominal case of expanding that to four EVAs, depending on the consumables. As you know, we had some problem with oxygen and water on this mission that got us down to just so we were able to accomplish the nominal mission in terms of total lunar surface stay time. The hardware question is almost completely, I think, a question of budgets. Right now, NASA's budget doesn't allow any extensive new development of hardware. There are all sorts of good ideas, but unless the Congress and the administration are willing to put those kind of monies into R&D for NASA, I think that we'll have to make do with what we have. And there are other priorities that in the country that determine what you put your money into at any given time. We have a pretty flexible system in terms of what we thought we had when we first landed on the moon, or just before we landed on the moon. I don't know anybody, including myself, you could have convinced that we could take the same basic spacecraft we landed on the moon with in 69 and be staying there for 3 days with it. There were lots of conservatives in those days, and I think we've done an extremely rapid job in making liberals out of a lot of people.
Jack, there were two more hands that were up at the start, I believe, two patient hands, one here and one here. I apologize to the rest of you. I hope you two have quick questions, and we'll take you two as the last two questions, please.
Yeah, Pete Baldwin, Aviation Week. We watched the TV camera pan in and out, zoom in and out, and then move around and then go back and look at certain places. were these areas where you were able to get some real-time geological information? And was the other point for that to possibly guide the crew as to what to go out and get or photograph or what?
In the latter part of your question, no. The camera was not directing the crew in any way. I think that this being the first time we'd had a mobile television system on the moon, there are a lot of things we learned from it, from the use of it, and the real-time operation that I hope will be discussed and factored in into improving that operation on the next one. Most of the TV operation was done, I think, in a systematic way that had been pre-planned. We had planned prior to the mission that at each stop, as soon as the TV came up, to try to get a wide-angle panorama of the area, and then depending on what the back science team saw, they might direct some specific, as a function of seeing that pan, some specific areas to zoom in on and look at. And then the follow to that, as I understand it, was mainly to watch what the crew was doing so that you could be ready to assist them at any time. And I think in general that was accomplished. I think the science team had not been fully convinced of all the things you could do with television on the moon. And I think that now for the next mission you'll find that there'll be many discussions and some new plans laid of how to more effectively utilize that television. I think it's going to be hard just from a personal point of view to top some of those early scenes we saw with that camera. That panorama that we were exposed to from St. George Crater is probably something that would be awful hard to beat, the television industry or anybody to beat for a long time to come. That was a fantastic show. I think in terms of making it another workable tool to increase our flexibility for lunar exploration, that the television will gradually improve with 16 and 17, and I'd like to have a chance to answer that question after 17. I think it was good. I think it can be better.
Over here for the last question.
Well, you've worked with the drill, and there aren't many missions left, and you say there's no money to develop new equipment, but man hours on the moon are so expensive, and so many of them were spent working with this drill. In your mind, is it the best piece of equipment, disregarding weight and just thinking of the size of a piece of equipment you could get into the lunar module, maybe at the expense of something else? Is this the best drill or core sampling device that you could fly to the moon? And do you recommend its continued use with the possible same consequences on the last two missions?
I think there are ways to take this drill and make it so it will not as seriously impact the timelines as it did here. I think, for example, one of the biggest things that hurt us on the core part of the operation, coring part, was the removal of the drill. Another big thing was breaking the sections down. These are all problems we'd had in training with the drill, and everybody realized that we were running that risk of having those same problems on the moon. Well, I hope everybody realized it. I think now that it's been demonstrated, and in fact that is a problem, I'm sure that we will recover ourselves and we'll have some kind of a levering device to pull it out, for example, would be my guess, and a better set of vices and wrenches to break down the core. It may be we'll even, now that we've learned how to bring back three sections at a time, we'll just break it once right in the middle. I think that would be a very reasonable thing to do. Although it had been desired by the scientific group to bring the core back in one of the vacuum boxes, the rock boxes, to preserve its any transient components that might be in there. Drilling, I come from a background of the mining industry that is intimately involved with drilling, and when I first started working with the engineers on the drill some 5 or 6 years ago, I tried to point out, and I think they realized too, that drilling a hole, recovering a core in fine grain debris at the surface of a planet or the Earth is probably the most difficult thing you can do in drilling. It has never been done successfully, really, on Earth. The fact that I'm pretty sure that we have done it successfully on the Moon, even at the expenditure of time, will more than justify that time if we, in fact, do learn the story about the Sun that I've discussed before. I think that there might be, with a large expenditure of effort and engineering talent, you might come up with a better way to drill a hole. Right now, I don't know what it is. It's just not an easy task, and the mining industry's been working on it for decades, and NASA took a large part of that experience and tried to do a better job on the Moon. I suspect we've done it, but it cost us quite a bit in time. I think you'll see an improvement on that on the next mission. I would not advocate at this time discarding the drill from the missions. If we find that in the analysis of that core, and I'd like to see NASA's sample team make a concentrated effort to look at that core and see if we how much we gain scientifically by having the deeper portions of it. And if you found that, well, we really it doesn't look like we're going to gain significantly from that, and I think that's wrong. I think we will gain, but if you found that out, then you would, I think, go back and concentrate on the double drive tubes, which are look like that in general they're you can get a core with those if you pick your site right. But right now, I think that's not what they'll find. I think they'll find the deeper portions of that core are extremely valuable, and that we'll continue to try to get the core, but we'll try to improve our operation so it doesn't take the time it took.
Okay, thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
That completes our conference. As announced, the astronauts are awake, and we expect we'll be getting a report shortly from Mission Control. The next briefing will take place here in this room at 10 o'clock. The topic is the Apollo 15 subsatellite. 10 o'clock here in this briefing room. Thank you.